This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour this Friday, April 12th. I'm Philip Nice, and I've got four Philadelphia Trumpet staff writers here with us in studio here in Edmond, Oklahoma, and they're in Edstone, England. We've got Mihailo Zekic.
Good to be here.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And we'll be joined by Andrew Miller. And every week you tune in to hear these four men summarize the news of the week, region by region, Middle East, Europe, Asia, and Anglo-America. We're going to be covering, obviously, the Middle East first. A lot of news happening there, even just today and over the past 24, 48 hours, and all week long and all month long. So, Mihailo Zekic, you watch the Middle East. Give us a quick rundown of the main things that have been happening just right up to the moment.
Yes. So, instead of starting off with something that did happen, I'm going to mention something that didn't happen, which is Iran's retaliation for Israel's embassy attack last week. We've been waiting for a while for Iran to do something right now. They've been dragging their feet, but the Israelis are expecting something to happen from Iran within the next 24 to 48 hours. What exactly they may be, we don't know. Netanyahu himself said they're preparing for other fronts in the Gaza war specifically to crop up, so or something along those lines. So what exactly that means, what they know that they're not telling us, we'll find out in 2 days, possibly.
Yeah, that's right. Also, the headlines are saying they've got Netanyahu on there saying that Israel is expecting an imminent attack from Iran, not in Iran proper necessarily, but not Gaza. So not within Gaza, but some other attack from some other front. So we'll be watching that closely. You'll be watching that closely, I know.
Yes, Israel, for its part, has said that if Iran attacks Israel, they will launch an attack within Iran itself. The initial fears of this sparking into a tit-for-tat World War III invasion of Danzig looks like that's passed, but the threat of a wider escalation is not. Speaking of the Gaza war, some pretty interesting news from there. Ismail Haniyeh, the leader of Hamas, although there's a few guys chalking for position, Hamas's politics is pretty complicated, but he's sort of the main guy everybody looks to as the leader. He's in Qatar. And three of his sons died in Israeli airstrikes. He has plenty more to go. I think the last time I saw, he has 10 surviving sons, so he has a pretty big family. He said that this is not going to change anything, that this is not going to get him to emotionally crack and start releasing hostages. For their part, releasing hostages in the hostage negotiations, Israel demanded that Hamas release 40 women hostages, elderly hostages, the infirm, etc. They gave a list of criteria excluding military-aged young men. And Hamas, for their part, said that they don't have enough hostages left alive to fulfill that criteria, which worryingly suggests that the number of hostages we think that are still alive might actually be less than even the Israeli intelligence community is able to know about. And finally, the big story that people are expecting or have been expecting for weeks now is the Rafah invasion. Benjamin Netanyahu said that they have marked down a date for the invasion. And soon after, he was contradicted by his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, who said there is no date. So we don't know exactly what's going on there, but that's obviously still on Israel's mind. And most likely some invasion will be happening sooner than later.
And whether or not it happens in the next 24 hours or 48 hours, speaking of the attack from Iran and the counterstrike from Israel, the suffering's already happening, right? We're often looking forward to what's going to happen next, but the suffering is happening now. You have the main topic. So of all the news that's happening in the Middle East this week, I'm asking you to boil it down into the one main story and one sentence to give us the upshot of what the main thing in the Middle East is this week.
I could even sum it up in one word: propaganda. And a lot of that propaganda, which we often talk about on this program in our magazine, surrounding the war, surrounding Hamas's charm offensive, shall we say, to show how evil the Israelis are, how much they're suffering under the occupation. There was a bit of news this week that cut through a big chunk of that. Specifically, the IDF released a video of an investigation from the spokesman, or one of the spokesmen, of Palestinian Islamic Jihad. That's not Hamas, but it's another Iran-backed terror group in Gaza that's fighting with Hamas. This gentleman, Tariq Simli Ussa Abu Shlouf, he was recorded on video by the IDF in his interrogation, basically admitting that Hamas and Islamic Jihad, or PIJ, they basically run every single hospital in Gaza. We often hear about some tunnel networks being found about this one hospital or that hospital. This guy, and I've seen the interview for myself, it seems pretty sincere. He's not sort of like hesitating and like trying to give Israel what they want. He's like listing statistics. He's listing names like off the top of his head. It's, again, I wasn't there, but it seems pretty genuine from what we can tell. And he's saying that every single hospital in Gaza is basically a terror center. He's saying that not even just every hospital, but every department in the hospital usually has one or two rooms reserved within there, like for terrorism purposes. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is for the past like month after month, oftentimes we'll see headlines saying that Israel bombed the hospital. Look at all these like people dying and like how could they target women and children? This is why. And not only is this why, but in the interview, the interrogator also brought up about Hamas is staging videos of, you know, like having people like pretend they're dead on the street. And then later we see videos of those same people eating a sandwich or whatever, and tying it into, this propaganda from these hospitals burning. I mean, obviously, when strikes happen, there's going to be some death. But a lot of what you see, more than probably any of us realize, circulating on the internet is very, very much staged. And the reason Israel goes after these hospitals is, again, because they're military targets. Specifically, the spokesman said that hospitals, they have 24-hour electricity. They have 24-hour access to internet. I mean, that in and of itself makes it an ideal place to have a military presence. Sometimes the mainstream media does debunk these stories, but when they do, it's usually not nearly with as much fanfare as when the initial headline comes around that Israel bombed a hospital. Like, the Palestinians are very, very good at propaganda. And the reason only I know about this is from Ynet News, which is an Israeli site. I don't see too many Western sources mentioning this. And again, you know, it's the fog of war. There's obviously a lot going on. There's obviously going to be a lot of different accusations or whatnot, or judgments made when something happens without realizing it. But when you look back at everything the media has been doing and about how every time Israel does something, it's always in the negative. It's always the worst possible outcome it could possibly be. And then when some of this information comes to light, you never hear about it. That tells you something, not just about PIJ or Hamas, but also the news mediums that are carrying their stories that know this stuff is going on. I mean, this kind of stuff is not new as far as Palestinians are concerned. This kind of stuff has been happening since Hamas has taken over Gaza. For people that have been following it for long enough, they know this kind of stuff is routine and they're staying quiet about it. It's just another assault, at least as far as the media is concerned, on Israel. And more of this information is coming to light to show just how much of a facade it is.
Well, that's a good point. Propaganda. It's another word for a war of morals. It's a war of ideas. It's a war of who are we going to be? What type of people are we going to be when outright, undeniable, actual terrorists, murderers, rapists, men who have committed murders as they have committed rape, are hiding in hospitals, violating international law, violating the laws of war, violating what we thought were our morals. If that's happening and the evidence is there that it is happening, and Israel, you mentioned them bombing hospitals. I know there's the Al-Shifa where they, an Israeli bomb hit the parking lot. I might be wrong, but I don't see them bombing it. I see them sending in infantry, which is I mean, if you want to just get rid of your enemies, you just carpet bomb. That's not what Israel's doing.
Well, that Al-Shifa, that was Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Like,
right, right. So Israel, when you mentioned bombing hospitals or them being framed as bombing hospitals, I see infantry in hospitals. That's a much different thing than just press a button from an F-16 and ignore the collateral damage. And you said there's the fog of war, yes, but this Pallywood, that's what we used to call it, you know, the Palestinian propaganda, you said they're very good about it. I would say they're not. You can see through it, but everybody's kind of pretending that it's legitimate. And so what I was trying to say is, if this is true, if this is what's happening, then what does that say about us? That we're pretending that this is legitimate, that we're pretending that Hamas can continue to exist. There's something very morally at stake in the larger world that's watching this, just like there's life and death at stake there in Gaza.
Well, when I said they're really good at it, I meant that they're really good at, for the average guy that doesn't know all this history and that's only seeing what their allies in the media are putting out there, they're really good at making the status quo for when people look online being everything we just said.
Maybe they've gotten better, but when you see the funeral procession and you see the guy moving, the dead body moving a little.
Well, that's fair.
You know, so maybe they've gotten better in recent years. But we could go on and on about things we've seen and think about this. But what guides your thinking when you're looking at the Middle East week to week?
Well, of course, the lens that we look through everything on here is Bible prophecy. And often on this program, I speak about prophecies like in Daniel 11, like in Psalm 83, that list specific nations and the specific actions we want them to take. This time, I want to take a bit of a different turn and just focus on a general trend that we see happening all over the world, not just in the Middle East, but with the Israel-Hamas war especially, you notice. And that is just truth being cast down to the ground. That is lies just being so all-encompassing and the truth being just so hard to sift out from those lies. And people with malicious motives, people that have an interest in shaping and molding the public's thinking to think a certain way that's not good, just having a lot of power. In particular, a passage of scripture that came to mind was 2 Timothy 3, verse 1 mentions the last days, the time we're living in right now. And it talks about those days being perilous times, that people would be false accusers. And that word actually comes from the Greek diabolos, if you know Spanish, relates to diablo, the devil. It's another name that the Bible gives to the devil. And specifically in verse 13, I wanted to focus on, it says, "But evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived." With something like the Israel-Hamas war, but in general, with what happens in every quarter of our world, I think there is not a better scripture that sums up the news. Evil men and seducers, people seducing, waxing worse and worse, deceiving and even believing their own lies. And as time goes on, we're going to be seeing the difference between truth and lies, or at least the ability to discern between those two, getting worse and worse. And so, as that happens, it's important to be grounded in scripture, and it's important to be grounded in fact, and to be grounded in history and some of these other things to just know what's going on. And if our listeners would like to learn more, I cited an article I wrote for our January edition, Truth and Lies, about the Israel-Hamas war. It is a little bit dated. There has been some updates to those statistics since we first wrote that. But that's good for anybody wanting to learn more about the truth of this conflict. And I'd recommend just even looking online, you can get a PDF of it, doesn't cost you anything. That whole January edition, it's our post-truth world edition, our special report. And it covers not just what's happening in Israel, but in a lot of other places on how to stay grounded in the truth and how to know what's true and what's not and how to inform your choices based on that truth.
Truth and Lies about the Israel-Hamas war. Such a good perspective, Mihail. I'm glad you brought that to us in the way that you did. And again, you can get that at thetrumpet.com, Truth and Lies about the Israel-Hamas war. And just know that there is a war going on, and it's not just over there in Israel. It's a war of truth and lies. Every voice that comes to you on the radio says, "I'm telling you the truth." But what you've got to do is understand that the war is absolutely raging. You have only one hope, that is the truth. And you've got to prove it for yourself. TheTrumpet.com can lead you to proving that for yourself. Not just believing Trumpet Hour or TheTrumpet.com, but finding and believing and proving, absolutely proving the truth. Obviously, an ongoing process, but a necessary one when there's an absolute war over the truth raging as we speak. The next region we go to is Asia. Jeremiah Jacques, you have watched Asia this week, as you watch it every week. Give us a quick rundown of the top stories.
America is empowering Japan. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, he visited the White House Wednesday, and President Joe Biden there during that visit, he called the U.S.-Japan alliance, quote, stronger than it's ever been. So this high-level visit came after the U.S. had already announced plans to reorganize its forces in Japan to be able to work more closely with a new joint Japanese command. It also comes as America is helping Japan boost its own arms industry. This visit also comes after years of massive military spending increases by the Japanese. Japan has boosted its military spending by over 50% just over the last 2 years, and America wants to help them keep on arming more and more. Japan is also now a partner in America's next lunar mission. So for the first time, there will be a non-American walking on the moon, if it all goes as planned, a Japanese astronaut. So military analysts are saying that Japan has become America's most important ally since it is, you know, a military powerhouse and becoming more and more powerful all the time, and since Japan appears to be closely aligned with America. But the problem is, Japan's alignment with America will not last. Bible prophecy shows that soon all of that firepower that America is now helping Japan to acquire will be used in stunningly destructive ways, and Japan will turn against America. So it's easy to see why America wants to work with Japan right now. You know, we think we have a powerful ally against China and against Russia, but it is a short-sighted decision and one that will help to bring about some truly dark days. Also, a quick story here about Chinese hackers. There was an update from the FBI this week saying that China's armies of hackers are rapidly growing. One quote from this says, "To quantify what we're up against, the People's Republic of China has a bigger hacking program than every other major nation combined." End quote. And then FBI Director Christopher Wray said the Chinese Communist Party is, quote, sparing no expense in its attempt to hack, lie, cheat, and steal its way to the top as a global superpower. And he admitted that the U.S. is really ill-prepared to deal with this. He said that China's attackers now outnumber U.S. defenders by 50 to 1 in cyber warfare. So very chilling to see how much the Chinese are focused on hacking the U.S., and it makes you wonder how long it'll be before some major destruction results from one of these Chinese cyber attacks.
You know, think about the Japanese, and I've learned and noticed more and more recently, they are a great, great people.
Truly.
They are their own people, and they are a great, great people. I've just been noticing that in what they make in particular, their culture as well, their language, cuisine, of course.
I think if every chef in the world was Japanese, the world would be a better place.
Yeah. You know, they are a great, great people, and you just want that to be for the good, but right. It can be turned or even dominated unwillingly, perhaps. We don't know exactly how it's going to turn out, but you want that to be used for good, just like you want the good qualities of the Americans or whoever else to be used for good on this planet. But Bible prophecy does guide us to be very wise. So that's a quick review. And in this program, we're often looking ahead. We just talked about in the Middle East, like what's going to happen in the next 24 to 48 hours. But I made the point, and I think I'm going to make it again, that the suffering's already happening. The suffering that we fear will happen or that we feared would happen last week has happened this week. And we're seeing that just every single day in a way that you could get numbed to in Asia and in Russia and in Ukraine.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the big story that I wanted to talk about this week is that Russia's army is now 15% larger than when it invaded Ukraine 2+ years ago. That's according to a new assessment published this week by U.S. Army General Christopher Cavoli. He is NATO's supreme allied commander in Europe, and his data shows that over the last year or so, Russia increased its frontline troop strength from about 360,000 to 470,000. So this is partly because Russia has now absorbed the forces of the so-called Donetsk People's Republic and also the Luhansk People's Republic, both regions of eastern Ukraine. But, you know, Russia has conquered those regions, so now those people are his people, and they're fighting against the rest of Ukraine along with, you know, the rest of the Russians. And then Russia has also been mobilizing hundreds of thousands of new recruits from Russia proper. So all of this has more than offset the hundreds of thousands of casualties that Russia has suffered. And now their forces are 15% larger and expected to keep on growing. And this week, we've also clearly seen what Russia is doing with its growing firepower. The numbers just came in for last month showing that during March, Russia struck 12 medical facilities and 32 educational facilities in Ukraine. And then just this week, Russia hit two of Ukraine's major underground gas storage facilities. Those strikes sent European gas futures just soaring. And then most significantly, just yesterday, Russia used one of its new KH-69 missiles, an extremely advanced new missile, to thoroughly destroy Ukraine's Tripolia thermopower plant. It was near the capital of Kyiv, which, of course, is far from the front lines, way over toward the west of Ukraine. And that plant supplied about 3 million people with power around the capital. It was the largest electricity provider in that region. So it was just a devastating blow. So it's clear that Russia is using its growing force size and growing firepower to pulverize Ukraine. And the Ukrainians are increasingly just unable to defend against these kinds of attacks.
Delays in delivery of air defenses will allow Russian missiles to hit more targets. And delays in delivery of ammunition will allow Russia to press along the front line. Ukraine simply cannot wait. It needs air defenses, ammunition, and aid now.
That was NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg there, just acknowledging the the seriousness of the attacks that Russia is consistently waging now. And he's encouraging NATO members to help Ukraine defend against these attacks more. But there's a real absence of will in some NATO nations, including the United States, to stand up to Russia in a meaningful way. So it's hard to see how the situation will turn around.
And when you don't have electricity, you suffer. The people of Ukraine, having endured this for years now, this ongoing grinding conflict, dying at power plants this week, dying in their markets, as you've mentioned before, in their apartments from these missile strikes, or closer to the front at the muzzles of Russian rifles. And as you were describing that there, I was just thinking about the man behind it all. And I think he's thinking, this is it. I'm doing this now. We've talked a lot in the past about the Russian demographic disaster that's just basically ongoing, and it's had its financial and economic difficulties too, but the unavoidable demographic disaster. And then I was thinking about that, and then he's pouring these demographics into a war machine, grinding up a lot of them. I think he's thinking, now or never, this is happening in my lifetime, and that's going to lead to more of the same at a higher and higher rate of death and casualty, I think.
Yeah, very good point there. And I mentioned a moment ago that there is an absence of will in the United States to work against Russia. And I'd like to read a quick quote here from Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. This is from an article in our May-June 2022 edition of the Trumpet magazine. So it's just a short time after Russia's full-scale war on Ukraine started. And Mr. Fleury writes, "As Russia has flattened Ukraine, the United States has done little in response. For years, we've allowed Putin to get away with aggressive behavior. Our leaders, especially Barack Obama and Joe Biden, would not challenge him in a meaningful way. The fruits of our weakness are now on display in Ukraine. America's weak will led to this crisis." End quote. That's Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury there. He goes on from there to talk about America's refusal to send serious weaponry like fighter jets to Ukraine to help them defend. And he just, you know, laments the foolishness of those kinds of decisions. And he makes clear that America's weak will and our failure to give adequate support to Ukraine and our failure to stand strongly against Russian aggression is the reason for all this. And he said that that's all because of our broken will, which was prophesied to be a curse against this nation. That's in Leviticus 26, the passage about the curse of America's broken will. So for anyone who would like to understand America's failure to stand up meaningfully against Russian aggression in the context of Bible prophecy, I think that article would be extremely helpful. It's called Bible Prophecy Comes Alive in Ukraine.
That's a Bible prophecy comes alive in Ukraine. So we're seeing strong resolve from the Russian side. It absorbs huge losses, huge loss of blood, loss of life, and comes right back. Then you contrast that to the Western side, the American side, and you have broken will. Mr. Fleury asserts that that prophecy mentioning broken will applies to American foreign policy in Ukraine versus Russia. So you'll learn more about that with Bible Prophecy Comes Alive in Ukraine at thetrumpet.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Trumpet Hour Week in Review on KPCG.
Listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Welcome back to KPCG and welcome back to Trumpet Hour. This is the Week in Review edition of the program. We've covered the Middle East and Asia. Now we're going to cover Europe. Richard Palmer, you're ready to give us a rundown of stories from Europe.
Germany's central bank played a major role in financing the Nazi conquest of Europe and willingly helped take Jewish assets, according to a new report from the Bundesbank. Many of these same staff stayed in place after the war. It's the latest in a series of reports over several years showing how many Nazis were underground in Germany's post-war government. Initially, it was claimed that these kind of lower-level functionaries had nothing to do with the Nazi crimes, and this is just another report that shows that that is completely false. Germany will spend 7 billion euros on two new Navy frigates and hundreds of armored fighting vehicles this quarter. Bloomberg reported this week the government is going to buy two F-126 frigates for about 3 billion euros. That will take Germany's total number of this particular type of frigate to six. And they're ordering 900 armored transporters manufactured by Rheinmetall. At the same time, the French Navy, one of their rear admirals, gave an interview to Politico saying, well, they're shifting their operations away from policing and they're getting into war fighting. Last week, we talked about the entire German military making similar kinds of changes. And the EU has agreed a new migration pact. In theory, this will distribute migrants all over Europe instead of leaving the burden mostly on the border countries. But it doesn't really do much to stop migrants coming into Europe. And so it doesn't seem like it's going to do much with the problem. And you will continue to see the anger within Europe at the migrant crisis growing. And then also this week, we had some new stats from Germany showing that violent crime is up significantly to the highest level since 2015. And half of that violent crime, or 60%, was committed by non-Germans. So it's becoming very clear that this migration is leading to massive amount of violent crime. This is rapes and murders and attacks. It's feeding through to making life measurably worse for a lot of people.
For a lifetime now, Europe has been kind of this overall safe zone, this kind of buffer between America and Russia or the Soviet Union. And again, you've written that article about Europe becoming more muscular. Something's boiling there, right? I mean, we're used to Europe being just kind of a place to appreciate architecture and history and culture and not being a force, certainly not a major opponent or threat, but Europe is definitely changing. Something's going on, and you say from week to week where this is heading, but I think it's just absolutely undeniable that something's going to change in Europe. Something is boiling over there. Earlier, we were talking about the war of ideas and this war of morals, out of which comes the actual wars and the actual conflicts and the actual physical suffering. Your main story I see here in the outline has to do kind of with this war of ideas and war of governance in the European Court of Human Rights.
That's right. This is utterly bonkers. So if your government doesn't put in place tough climate regulation, they are violating your human rights. So your government may be forced to ban you from using your car if it's petrol powered, say, or they might have to put on heavy, heavy taxes on your heating. And there is nothing you can do about that at the ballot box. Like, you can no longer afford to drive now and you can't vote for a different party. You are forced to do this by a court in Luxembourg, the European Court of Human Rights. And this applies all across Europe. So this particular ruling comes from Switzerland. So the argument is, and this is classic human rights inflation, like we all like talking about political philosophy here, I think, or like the Federalist Papers and the U.S. Founding Fathers. They didn't want America to be a pure democracy. They saw the dangers in that, that if you have a pure democracy, then in theory, the population can vote for whatever they want. They could vote to genocide a segment of the population, a minority, or enslave, or anything. And so it's like, okay, well, we need to have constitutional law. We need to have laws that even a majority cannot break. And Europe took that in the form of the European Court of Human Rights, but they've applied a very elastic view in what these laws are, to be stretched to the point now that it's used to just squash democracy. So in this case, a bunch of older Swiss women brought a case and said, well, the European Court of Human Rights, it enshrines non-discrimination and it enshrines a right for family life. And as older Swiss women, if we get climate change, that could lead to longer and hotter heat waves, and we would be disproportionately impacted by that. The elderly would be, and women would be, and they produce some kind of statistics along those regards. Therefore, governments have a duty to stop this from happening. And the court agreed. And, you know, Switzerland, their constitution requires referenda for a lot of big things. They had a referendum in 2021 on very tight climate change regulation and voted against it. And now this court is saying, well, you may have even had a referendum. You didn't just, it wasn't just your representatives voting. You put it to direct democracy. Doesn't matter. You must do this. You must legislate against climate change. Oh, and this is something that we're going to see more often. Greta Thunberg talked about how they wanted to apply this in more courts, and this gives them more ammunition to do that.
And this is only the beginning of climate litigation. All over the world, more and more people are taking their government to court, holding them responsible for their actions. And this, the results of this can mean in no way that we lean back. This means that we have to fight even more.
So this is something that is binding on Britain, even though we've left the EU. It's binding on Germany, France, everywhere. You could see countries being forced to enact tough climate change regulations, and voters can't do anything to stop it.
So all of the constitutional and political structures that are in place, am I overstating this, that this European Court of Human Rights that has little to do with the average European is overriding enormous, long-standing, widespread structures of democracy, as we call it, and the rule of law? They're overriding everything based on a case of women saying it's too hot and you need to protect our human rights by dictating human rights, and all based on the supposed science of climate change. This is, the word you use is appropriate. Bonkers.
Right. And I think what astonished me is this, there was only one dissenting vote. Again, like, it was almost unanimous. So when more cases like this come, they're going to vote the same way. And it is nonsensical. Like, okay, well, first of all, you have to to make this ruling, you have to believe climate change is real. And, you know, that Greta Thunberg, who has repeatedly said the world is going to end by such and such a date, and it hasn't, that is happening. You have to then accept that government measures will prevent climate change.
Right.
Which a lot of times that's not completely clear. And often you look at the actual effect and they make things worse. It just means maybe we produce half the amount in this country, but then three times more in China. And you have to accept that what Switzerland does actually matters when it comes to climate change, which Switzerland, not to disparage Switzerland, is a pretty tiny percentage of carbon emissions and falling, like most Western European countries have had their carbon emissions. You know, you have to accept all of that. But even if you do, dramatically more older people die of cold than of heat. Like, it's not even close. You look at excess deaths in summers versus winters, massively more in winters. So by the court's own logic, actually, government should try and cause more climate change because that will save more elderly lives. So actually, governments would have a legal responsibility to pollute. They're clearly just cherry-picking facts and logic and Kate's to reach this preordained conclusion,
right?
And only one member of the court dissented from this.
That is absolutely wild. I'm thinking of what we were saying earlier, like, what's going on here? Like, when you treat murderous terrorists the way that we're treating Hamas, and I mean we average people in the Western world, you know, you have to wonder what is going on with us. or what we tolerate with Russia. And then what you're describing here is, like you said, it is a preordained conclusion. We want the flow of power to come away from the individuals, away from the individuals' representatives, and to a small group of people at the top of Europe. What kind of sickness, what kind of like moral sickness is allowing something so crazy to be treated like it's legitimate? I don't. I think people need to ask that question.
Something we've been talking about in recent weeks, that Europe is kind of, there's these two different roads to dictatorship ahead for Europe, where you've got these kind of faceless elites accumulating more and more power, whether it's over climate change here and government bureaucracy and things like clamping down on free speech and European regulations on what can be said online. And you know, that is creating a pretty autocratic, dictatorial form of government that someone even more ruthless than some of these bureaucrats could really take advantage of. But also, I mean, look at the reaction going the other way all across Europe. Like, we've had pretty violent protests, well, not violent, but dramatic protests all across Europe this winter, with, you know, farmers' protests and others, and big environmentalist movements. But how, like, getting yourself out from under the European Court of Human Rights is really hard. For some European countries, it's been enshrined in their constitution. It's enshrined in Europe. It's separate from the European Union. It's a function, I believe, of the Council of Europe, which is not the same thing as the European Council or the Council of the European Union. This is kind of dictatorship through obscurity. Nobody understands what's going on. The European Convention of Human Rights that empowers the court is a precondition to being part of the EU. So it's not clear, really, legally, if you can be an EU member while dissenting from the European Convention on Human Rights. Would you have to leave the EU to reject this? Like, the path to rejecting it is very tricky and torturous. And this is where things like migration comes in as well. You're a big part of the reason for migration crisis in Europe is the European Convention on Human Rights that says if someone comes to Europe and has a pet cat, you can't deport them because they have a right to a family life. That's a slight exaggeration, but that's the kind of rulings that we have. And almost every time you try and deport someone, they have umpteen avenues of appeal all the way up to this higher court. And this is why it's almost impossible to deport. So for all of Europe, you've got farms being shut down and economies destroyed because of environmental regulation. You've got massive violent crime because of migrants. And all the way in your way is the European Court of Human Rights and the European Convention on Human Rights. So what do you do? Like, the if you want to deal with this urgently and quickly, the quickest solution is completely smash the system or just do away with the rule of law. And you're getting a lot of European leaders saying, well, we're just going to break the law to deal with these crises. The court will say something, forget them, which is understandable. Like, we're talking, like, what the court is doing is bizarre. But right. At the same time, saying, well, we're just going to ignore the law. Well, that's dangerous. And that's opening the way to demagoguery and strongman rule. And rule so of both of these... Yeah, exactly. Put Europe on this path to autocracy and dictatorship. That is a clearly prophesied destination. And that's where we do have our trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of a European or a German Strongman. This is what the Bible says is coming. Scripture after scripture that talks about Europe being led in this dictatorial fashion and rulings that dictate, well, what your religion is, what day of the week that you can worship, a government that's very involved in your life. And you look at the path that Europe's on and okay, there's a few choices in the road, but that's where all these roads lead. We're on the path to exactly what the Bible forecasts.
So I absolutely can see people looking at this and thinking, oh, it's going to go this way, or it might go this way, or it might go that way, like you were saying. But the thing that I think is undeniable is it's going to move. Something's going to move. Something's going to change. Europe is boiling and it can't keep going on like this. And this is more than, I think, just the usual... Oh, the government, you know, and oh, the Europeans, and, you know, like, oh, they're over there doing that, but it's not going to have, you know, a big effect on me over here in North America or, you know, wherever I might live. Something's boiling, something's happening. Europe is far too great of a peoples and a power to not have a massive effect on the rest of the world, and we've got to be concerned about it. That's my point. And as you said, we can know which of those roads it's going to take forward, and you can see the steps moving, definitely moving. And if you know what to look for, you can see it moving in that direction. And that was Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of a German Strongman. That's there at thetrump.com/trends. So thanks, Mr. Palmer, for that update. We move to Andrew Miller. You're going to give us an update on Anglo-America. Go.
Yes, as crime gets worse in the big cities and millions of illegal immigrants pour over the border, more and more Americans are becoming concerned for their safety. And probably the best metric to prove that is a new report released this week by the National Shooting Sports Foundation showing that Americans bought more than a million guns last month. Actually, quite a bit more. I think it's like 1.4 million guns, which is, I think, close to a record high, brings up the estimated total of firearms in the nation to about 500 million. Just huge numbers. You can see that something that, Americans, they've always been a nation of sportsmen and things like that that use these recreational. But the recent uptick definitely does seem, when they poll it, to be due to, like, I'm concerned for my safety.
Two guns for every boy is what we seem to be heading for. And when the people are a moral people, when the war of morals and ideas is going fairly well, then that can be helpful, as you pointed out before, as a check on the government and its monopoly on force. When you don't have a moral people, when you don't have the safeties in place in people's minds and morals, that's actually kind of terrifying.
It is an enormous amount of firepower in a very fraught political situation. Another indication of how divided politics is getting is Joe Biden's latest plan to drum up voter support for himself. His approval ratings are approaching Jimmy Carter levels heading into an election year. So he's come up with a new scheme that the Supreme Court will most likely strike down to offer $10,000 in student loan forgiveness to something like 30 million people. So $300 billion bill, if it went through, I did the math, every taxpayer would have to add $1,800 to their bill to pay for these 30 million people to not actually have to purchase the degree they already possess. And then the third story in my front down rundown is the war on free speech is escalating even more, with the Brazilian Supreme Court justice opening an investigation into American businessman Elon Musk for allowing certain Twitter accounts, or certain X accounts, it's now called, in Brazil, that the Brazilian government wants censored. So they're threatening to either fine him like $20,000 a day or kick him out of the country. He's not backing down, but this is something we've covered on this program quite a bit about just like free speech under attack.
Right. That's a part of that moral war that we were talking about earlier. And I'm so happy that it's called X now. I refuse to use its former name. I found it infantile. So I'm really glad that Elon Musk changed the name. What's the main story from Anglo-America this week?
The coronavirus changed the world in far-reaching ways, maybe more far-reaching than anything in a generation, between like the debt and the lockdowns and the supply chain shortages, the resulting inflation, the entire generation of students that's now 1 or 2 years behind. And so it is really important for us to understand how that happened. And that is an Anglo-American story, as we're finding more and more about just how involved America was with that virus. The Senate Homeland Security Committee has been investigating this for a number of years, and its top Republican on that committee, Senator Rand Paul, actually came out this week with more information that a full 15 U.S. agencies knew that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was attempting to graft a spike protein from a bat coronavirus onto the body of a mouse coronavirus to make a more potent coronavirus that they could use for vaccine testing. Senate reports also think it's highly likely that it was that hybrid virus that leaked out of the lab and caused the pandemic that had such far-reaching implications. So the Rand Paul, he's talking particularly about a project called Project Defuse, which is all the U.S. agencies involved. And it's like, and it wasn't just Dr. Anthony Fauci and a couple secret co-conspirators who were like funding this under-the-table research in Wuhan virology. But there's like full 15 U.S. agencies knew about this, were supporting it, in some cases were funding it. which makes it seem all the more sinister that the fact that they condemned anyone who said it leaked out of the lab as a conspiracy theorist right off the bat, until now the evidence is you've got receipts and you've got bank accounts and you've got pretty much everything you need to know that they were working on this. And it's something you need to be aware of. For Anglo-American News, we focus a lot on a prophecy in Isaiah 1 and verse 5 about the whole head being sick and the whole heart being faint. And using something like this as just the head means like the head of the nation or the government of the nation, just to show this the government corruption within the United States. But even from a global perspective, the fact that projects like this are going on are concerning. Because there's international treaties that limit outright biowarfare research. So normally, if you want to do biowarfare research, vaccine research is generally your best cover. Because you can take a virus, make it more deadly, and then use the claim that like, oh, well, we need this to test our vaccine on. So if China wants to do bioweapons research, you do it under the cover of vaccine research. If America wants to do bioweapons research, you do it under the cover of vaccine research. In this case, China and America were the two big players, but I can almost guarantee you that this sort of thing's going on in Europe as well. They don't want China and America to have all the bioweapons, so it's like they need to get some vaccine programs going here so that they can keep ahead of the curve with their gain of function technology. COVID showed us just how deadly even a relatively mild virus like COVID could be. And so this is something, as you're looking at some of these end time prophecies about, well, in Revelation 6, about global pandemics, or even the old Ambassador College Correspondence course, they talk about like five ways you could annihilate all human life from Earth. Nuclear war is the one that normally gets most of the attention. But biological warfare is another thing that's definitely making big strides. And as Senator Paul's recent report shows, big strides with full approval of the most powerful government on Earth at the time.
So much stood out from what you were just saying, but that point about 15 agencies knew, I think you said in 2018. And then in 2020, the unified message is saying it leaked from a lab in Wuhan is a conspiracy theory and probably racist. That is wrong. And what's wrong is wrong, whether the Chinese Communist Party is doing it, or some dictator in South America is doing it, or Africa, or the United States government is doing it. Like, what's wrong is wrong. We have a moral war on our hands, and it's on the hands of you as much as it is on the hands of your leaders. And you got to engage in it, because this is having real world mass scale ramifications, this moral war that we've been talking about. That's all the time we have for Trumpet Hour this week, the Week in Review program. We hope you've enjoyed and benefited and learned from these updates from our staff writers. You can learn more at thetrumpet.com. Also sign up for the Trumpet Brief there on thetrumpet.com. You'll get Mr. Palmer's thoughts even more regularly, which is always a good thing. You'll stay up with the news and have definitely a unique take on it that you can then go and prove from yourself, from other headlines, and as he has said, from Bible prophecy. We thank Isaac Lorenz and Parker Campbell sitting here at the keyboards and making sure that we get this program from this little studio in Edmond, Oklahoma to you wherever you are. Write to us at letters@thetrumpet.com. We appreciate hearing from you every week. And we'll be back with you next week on Trumpet Hour Week in Review.